This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
A missionary.
A coffee missionary. It's a spreading the word. That's right. My name is Dave Bateman. Trudy and I own Heavenly Hawaiian Farms in Hōlua'aloha, Hawaii.
Here we are on the top of the world.
On top of the world.
I now know why you call it heavenly.
Hualalai Volcano, just south of Kona, up Mauka, as we say, which means up the mountainside. Elevation here runs between 1,200 at the bottom of the farm on the Mamalohoa Highway, all the way up to 1,600 feet where we're sitting right now. And then the farm continues up Mauka, up the mountain, to about the 1,800-foot elevation. And so the entire farm is about a half a mile long, running from Makai, Oceanside, to Mauka, Mountainside. I'd say about 1,000 feet on average in width. We have 39 acres and about 20,000 coffee trees on this farm.
So when do you sleep?
What's that?
Let's roll back in time. You know, okay. What did you do before you were a coffee grower?
Going back to my education real quickly, I grew up in Southern California, Escondido, Oceanside area. Graduated from Escondido High, went to UCR Riverside, and graduated in 1963 with a degree in geology geophysics, and then went to law school, University of San Diego. Graduated in 69 with a JD degree. Passed the California bar in 1970, started practicing, and then Vietnam came along, and I drew a low draft number. So I had my choice. It was either Army or Air Force. I picked the Air Force. Ended up coming on active duty as a captain. McCord Air Force Base is my duty assignment, and there I was a defense counsel.
So you're a judge advocate.
I was a judge advocate, a little bit of marijuana, and so I ended up defending about 20 or 30 of them at one time. It was a very interesting career.
So and then, you're equivalent a defense attorney then?
Yeah, yeah. And then that was in 1972 to 75. 75, I was reassigned to Headquarters Air Force in Washington, D.C., where I did appellate defense work. And then Vietnam ended. I was there during the Carter administration. I came off active duty, went into the reserves, back to McCord Air Force Base, acted as an assistant staff judge advocate until I was promoted to full colonel. Then they moved me to Travis Air Force Base. So I was with 15th Air Force, finally retired in 1997. 78, I left D.C., came back to McCord Air Force Base, was in the reserves now, worked for the Attorney General for 4 years, doing all the aquatic lands work for the state of Washington. And office was in Olympia, Washington, the state capital. Meanwhile, taken and passed the bar to practice law in Washington State. And so I did that for 4 years, and then I broke back out into private practice. In 1982, you know, jack of all trades, you know, master of none, well, it kind of applied to me, but I did everything, and including toward the end of my time practicing law, did a lot of asbestos litigation, working with shipyard workers who built our ships in World War II at Bremerton, handling all the asbestos-related diseases and that type of thing, doing all kinds of thing, international contracts, a lot of real estate, construction law, and tort, a lot of personal injury, and did a lot of estate planning. In about 2005, one of my corporate clients had a large alarm company there in Olympia, Washington, met him through the local Rotary Club, been his attorney for now going on 45 years, I think it is. He had purchased farms over here in Hawaii and was going to purchase this farm, Heavenly Hawaiian. So he asked me to take a look at the paperwork, did, came over, looked at this thing, my jaw just dropped. That was my epiphany.
At that point, you were advocating for him, right?
I was advocating for him, giving him advice, and I saw this farm, and I said, my goodness gracious, Bob, the paperwork, this is, you know, the leases, these are long-term leases, 35-year leases with Kamehameha Schools, and the fine and the purchase and sale looked fine and this and that. And we came up to this very house that we're sitting in right now and had the sellers across the table and Bob and I, and we were talking and I made a comment just out of the blue. Man, Bob, I think this is fine. This is good. You know what? I think I could even sell Kona coffee. And everybody in that room looked at me and said, good, Dave, because we've been talking. So you're going to stop practicing law, and you're going to buy this farm.
So you were set up.
I think I was set up. And anyway, what a wonderful setup. So Trudy and I prayed about it for a week and then finally said, you know, let's just do it. So that was in February of 05. By March of 05, I was over here. I had found attorneys to take over some of the work at the law firm. It actually took me 5 years to wind down my law practice because I had to go back and try cases and do that kind of stuff. But I was here, and then Trudy followed a year later. She wanted to retire from Providence St. Peter. She was an emergency room nurse. So she came about a year later, and we lived in this house until our seller could build another house for his family and move out of the big house on the other side of the pool, where we eventually moved when he moved. Lived here about 10 years. About 4 years ago, we had an opportunity to buy a farm, again, from the same fella, my client. He built a beautiful home on leasehold land about 5-10 minutes north of here toward the village of Kailua-Kona. Great view, even more spectacular than this wonderful view. And so we said, okay, we'll buy that. So we've been there now for 4 years. But we still own this farm and come up here every day and continue to run it.
So in 05, when you came here, was it already planted?
This farm, yes, was planted. So we bought this farm and then the farm that goes all the way down to the highway. It's about 11 acres. This is about 27 and a half, give or take. And so that was mac nuts. So after 2 years of picking macs and fighting the pigs, because they come in the night, you got all your bags ready to go to market the next morning, and all the bags are ripped open, nuts all over the ground. So I just said, this is not worth it. So we ended up whacking the macs, as we said. I brought a big Komatsu grinder, shovel in, a huge grinder, and we just ground 660 mac trees to the ground. And then the coffee trees that were planted had not been blooming because there was no sunshine. They were totally covered. Previous farmer had gone from coffee to mac nuts and didn't take out the coffee trees. So fortunately, when we whacked the macs, pruned the coffee trees within a year or two, they started coming back, and now we got 11 acres of coffee plus 17 half acres, total about 20,000 trees on about 38 and a half, 39 acres.
What's the life expectancy of each individual plant tree?
The tree, if it's planted correctly, taproot, one single taproot, everything that we talked about in the seminar yesterday, that's done correctly. That tree should, in this environment, in Kona, Hawaii, should last 75 years. If we were in Central South America, because of all the disease, the heat, the weather, you know, all the pressure, the stresses on the tree, my answer would be maybe 25 years.
Pretty ideal growing environment.
This is one of the best growing environments in the world, and that maybe is why Kona Coffee is ranked number one in the world, just like I spoke about yesterday in my seminar. It is ranked number one, followed by Jamaica Blue. And Jamaica is a very similar growing environment to this. Ocean, volcano, good volcanic soil.
What you're saying is Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee comes in second to Kona?
Well, of course. I have to be loyal to my fellow Kona coffee farmers. But actually, the numbers speak for themselves. The demand, the sales off the shelf, et cetera. And it's interesting that Kona coffee, it's expensive. I mean, we're talking $40 to $50 a pound just for prime.
And how much would Jamaican Blue Mountain be?
Try about twice that. And guess what the extra premium is?
What?
It's a government tax. That's Jamaica makes a lot of its revenue through taxes on its Jamaica Blue coffee, which is excellent coffee. But when you put the two side by side, the value proposition is here in Kona. It's a much better buy for the dollar.
Okay, let's talk about the definition of what is Kona coffee, where it has to be grown, and what it has to be.
Kona is a specified district. It looks like a boomerang, and it starts out by the airport to the north of here at Kona International. The call sign is KOA, Koa Airport. It's up along the Mamalohoa Highway, which is the upper highway here, not the lower Kuakini Highway and the Queen Kahamanu Highway. It's the upper highway, and just follow that.
Is there an elevation requirement?
No, but your better coffees are going to be at the Mamalohoa elevation as it cuts across the volcano here down into across the Mauna Loa volcano.
You give us an elevation like 1,800 feet?
The ideal growing environment is pretty much the elevation of the highway, which is about 1,000 feet up Malka to 2,000 feet is the sweet spot for growing coffee here in Kona. Good soils, good rainfall, 60 to 80 inches is required. It's just a good environment. You can stand down by the water and look back up on the mountain. You can see the dry, and then all of a sudden you see where the rainforests are, and that's good growing environment. Good soil and rain are your two critical elements. And to answer your question, Mamalohoa Highway, 25 miles from the airport south to the village of Mililii, which is one of the first fishing villages on this island, established over 1,200 years ago. And that's the tail end, the south end of the Kona district. So again, it looks like a boomerang down there.
So there are some people growing closer to sea level, you're saying?
People do. The issue there is water. Here we get natural rain.
You dry farm.
You can't dry farm coffee, and that's the problem. You do need 60 to 80 inches for the Arabica varieties. Now, the Robusta varieties I spoke about yesterday, primarily in Vietnam and Indonesia, they're drier, but the coffees are, I told you, extremely bitter. I mean, I wouldn't feed Robusta to my worst enemy. It's pretty bad stuff. But there's a market. 25% of the world production is Robusta. 75% is Arabica. But to get a nice, sweet Arabica with the oils and the sugars properly developed at roasting that will give you a nice, sweet, mellow, full-bodied, flavorful, the Arabica grown at higher elevations. And in fact, in a lot of the marketing materials, you'll see high-elevation coffee, Central South America. Here, a good growing in elevation is, like I said, 1,200 to 2,000. That's ideal. That would equate to 6,000 to 7,000 feet in the mountains in Costa Rica, Brazil, Guatemala, Nicaragua, just to put it in perspective. A lot of people don't understand that. But you need the good volcanic soils. That's very important. And a good amount of rain. Moderate temperature here in Kona is boring, but boy, is it beautiful. It's 75 to 80 degrees year-round. Right now, you can feel the tropic breeze coming through our lanai. Our trees love it. A human being feels comfortable in that environment. This is kind of a little test. Guaranteed, the coffee trees are going to feel mighty good in that same environment.
As you alluded to yesterday in your presentation, just because somebody is a grower within the Kona growing region doesn't make it great coffee.
That's exactly right. First of all, the law requires Kona coffee to be grown in Kona. And I explained to you the boomerang-shaped district. It has to be grown here. It can't be grown north in Hamakua. Can't be grown south in the Kau district, which is at the south end of this, or in the Puna district over on the southeast side. It has to be grown in Kona. Number two, you are correct. There are many Kona coffees that are not fully developed with their oils and sugars because they're at a lower elevation, drier, not enough rain, the beans just haven't fully developed. And those can be bitter. If you don't develop the oil and sugar to overcome the natural acidity, you're going to end up with a bitter bean. So yes, you can have...
So that grower can label his coffee Kona coffee, correct?
And the market will determine whether or not it's marketable. But yes, he's legal, but the question is, can he market it? And so that's why it's very important for anybody seeking out the best of the best in Kona. You got to come and visit the farms or order coffee from all the farms. Just get a little sample and try them all until you find the one that hits your sweet spot.
So there's no hierarchical certification, grading system, point system that somebody on the mainland, if they went to a store to buy Kona coffee, how would they know?
By looking at the bag. And the problem is on the mainland, and we do have the Kona coffee, and it has a problem with this, comments I'm about to make. There is no regulation about Kona, designating a bag of coffee Kona on the mainland. Here, it's very strict. Has to be grown in Kona, and you have to make certain grade requirements. The lowest grade to be called Kona is called prime. You can have up to 20% defects, and that could be a bug hole, fungus, a chip bean, a moldy bean, mother bean, you know, and other defects, but you can only have 20% by weight. 100-pound bag of green cannot have any more than 20 pounds of green with one or two of those types of defects. Doesn't apply to the mainland.
Let's go mainland for a moment. Okay. So I'm in San Francisco and I go to Safeway. If I picked out a Kona coffee, it might not be grown in Kona district?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
So it could be from Kauai, it could be from Oahu?
Could be from Costa Rica, Guatemala, Brazil. That's correct.
That's a tough battle for you guys.
It is, and we're constantly fighting it.
What is your best hope to get that awareness ramped up for the consumer worldwide?
Again, it's a buyer beware situation.
That's a tough one.
It is, but what I would recommend, first of all, is you go to the website. If you see a coffee that's XYZ Kona Coffee Farm, go check it out. Most of the legitimate coffee sellers, the farmers and the producers on this island in Kona, will have a legitimate website. That's the first thing I would do. Number two, if you find what appears to be a legitimate farmer, then you have to ask yourself, okay, self, is it possible that this farm is buying coffee from another origin? Here's the problem we have. Currently, we produce about 3 million pounds of green bean, which is, the, as I explained yesterday in my seminar, the finished coffee product just before roasting. That's what goes into the roaster, okay? We only produce about 3 million on 4,000 acres, 800, 900 farms, nobody knows for sure. Okay, so that's the limit of your supply. But research has shown that not we, they are selling upwards of 20 to 30 million pounds of what they call Kona. And it's interesting. Finally, their time to roost has come, and they're being called out.
Who is they?
Four farmers got together and have filed litigation, a lawsuit in Seattle against multiple farms that they have good scientific reason to believe are masquerading other coffees from around the world as Kona. And they also went after Costco and Walmart and some of the distributors under a federal act. So the way they have scientifically proven this, and they won't disclose who their science lead witness is and the scientific methods they have, and we're very familiar with those in the Kona industry, and that's called tracing origin by chemical composition. And what they do is they look for certain elements, certain rare elements and certain natural elements that occur in each of the soils. So, for instance, Kona is going to have a certain agglomeration. So when you go ping it, it's going to give you a cluster of dots on these graphic charts and say, okay, you're in the lower left-hand corner because of these chemicals and the soil types and that kind of thing, and that analyzed through chemical analysis. Costa Rica is going to be way off the chart in the upper right-hand corner in this hypothetical chart I'm talking about. And so they can actually trace the chemical composition of the growing environment, even in the green for sure, but even all the way through roasting. And this is a brand new science. I sit on the board of the Hawaii Coffee Association. I've been sitting on that board for about 14, 15 years. We ourselves are very interested in this to protect the Kona coffee farmers and the Kau coffee farmers and the Maui coffee farmers, Molokai and Oahu. And so what we're doing is we're going to contract with a company out of the New Zealand, Australia area, and we're going to retain them so that if we have question, we're going to be able to detect fraud. And it's interesting that they've already, on their own dime, have come here and they've analyzed these soils. Look, they got their chemical things done, and they've also gone around the world doing it. So they're prepared. So if we have a case that we think is fraudulent Kona, we can then just send the beans down to them, and we have to pay for it, the analysis, but we can do exactly what the litigants in this case that was filed in the Seattle federal courts are doing right now. So chemical analysis is the key to proving fraudulent Kona on the mainland.
Listening in from the outside, this is inside industry aggravation and frustrations.
Yeah.
Me, again, as a consumer at a San Francisco Safeway, what I would love is some sort of sticker or some sort of certification on the bag of coffee that I would know, oh, my God, this is definitely certified true Kona. Is there talk of doing that?
Well, the problem is we do have certified 100%. The Kona Coffee Council has little 100% Kona stickers, and some of the other coffee associations do that too. But it's pretty easy to bootleg a roll of these things, you know.
That's going on?
And that has, we think, happened. I can't prove it, but we think that has gone too. So really what it comes down to is the industry disciplining itself. And that's why we're going to contract with these consultants who can actually analyze the origin scientifically to be able to prove by a preponderance of the evidence in a federal or state courtroom that this is not. So that's really the best thing. But stickers themselves don't answer the question.
As a consumer, again, what you're advocating is seeking and proving provenance myself by going to the websites and see where their coffee is grown.
It is the easiest, simplest, cheapest way to protect yourself. Just check them out and make sure that they're legitimate. And if you want to take it, you know, a little step further, you can also do some research to see if they've been involved in litigation or how the Better Business Bureau. But yes, do your homework on the website. It's very, very simple. That's the simplest way to do it. But just know that the coffee industry is now taking major steps to protect consumers here on the islands as well as on the mainland from these fraudulent masqueraders of false Kona coffee.
Let's shift to growing practices and some of the best practices that work for you and the deal breaker of trying to be truly organic.
Wow, that's a loaded question.
I know.
Oh my goodness, that is a tough one. There are two schools of thought. You know, organic is kind of the key word, the quintessential coffee is organic. And that's cool. If you have a good organic farmer that adequately fertilizes the coffee to enhance the flavor, the body, and all those good things that give you just that wonderful cup of Kona coffee. But the problem is getting enough fertilizer up the tree through the roots and up through the stem and out the branches to the fruit is tough. NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Nitrogen for the leaves, phosphorus for the root ball, and potassium and other micronutrients, iron, strontium, sulfur, whatever, for the fruit itself. And finding that in a natural environment is tough. And so I'm biased. I'm a conventional farmer, but we're kind of moving to organic standards. You know, like we're not using Roundup anymore on the farm. We use other methods of taking care of the weeds to make sure the tree gets all of the fertilizers, but we use conventional fertilizers, making sure that four times a year these trees get fed and during critical periods of their growth and the growth of the fruit so that they are adequately fed and the red cherry can maximize all of the nutrients necessary to create their 800 organic compounds that lead to a wonderful cup of Kona coffee when it's roasted. I have a bias against the organic because I don't see how you could survive in this tough labor. It's costly, the material costly environment, and we have a weather downturn. Last year, our crop came in at 50% because of the VOG, just before the volcano shut down south here, Kilauea volcano, before it shut down, and we had a drought. It was double whammy on us, and instead of the 260, 280 that we usually produce, we were down to about 120,000 pounds. So as a farmer, you got all these weather risks, et cetera. So
you're at net zero at the end of the season.
Oh, last year we took a hit, yeah. And so my point is, as a farmer that's trying to make a little bit of a profit, we don't get rich doing this, and how to make a small profit in the coffee industry, you start out with a huge, huge profit, and you're going to lose some. But we're doing okay. We've been blessed with some wonderful tours. Our tour business is picking up and our monthly customers. So we're able to kind of stay ahead of it. But I'll tell you, this is a very risky business. And being a conventional farmer, I think, gives us the added financial ability, sustainability, as opposed to being an organic farmer. I just don't see how an organic farmer can really survive in this tough environment, the cost environment.
Well, there are invasive bugs that can wipe you out, right? Unless you...
Oh, to your point, we spoke about this yesterday in the seminar. The big bug to hit us was a CBB, coffee berry borer, hit us in 2010. And it's a little bug, and the whole world's got it. And now guess what? Kona has it. The other islands, we're trying to protect them from getting it. But Kona got hit with it really hard. And it's a bug, like a little beetle, the size of a sesame seed, drills into the tail end of a coffee cherry, and it can be green, yellow, red cherry, raisin, that's a dried coffee cherry on the tree. They love hanging out in there. They drill in to lay their larvae. And that larvae is what digests the coffee. That larvae will eat your coffee bean or cause holes. So to fight that, we use an organic compound called Botanigard. And it's a fungus. It kills the beetle, but only if we get it before it has actually buried itself into the coffee cherry. And then it's got a shell around it to protect it. So we have to get it while it's outside the bean or just starting to drill into the bean. And that's how we've been fighting it.
So you are physically walking the fields and looking at the plants all the time?
Every week, yes, we do. We just were spraying here on the farm yesterday. The idea being that you want to keep your percentage defect down to about 5%, That's kind of sustainable. It allows you to get your prime grade, remember, 20% by weight defects. It helps get the coffees that are going to give you the money. But if you drop down into 3X, which is more than 20% damage, between 20 and 30% by weight damage, the value of that coffee is half the value at the low end of prime. And so you got to keep those defects to a minimum. And we're fighting that. We're fighting twig borer, cousin of the CBB, which goes out the limb and drills underneath the limb to lay its larvae inside the limb. And you've got cherry on those limbs. It doesn't kill the tree, but it will kill that limb. The only way, effective way, is you've got to cut that limb off, put it in a bag, let it sit in the sun until you kill that off. One disease that we don't have, thank God, but we're constantly on the watch for, and that's why we have quarantine services and quality control services through the State Department of Ag and the USDA. They will not allow coffee trees, coffee plants in from foreign countries. And the reason being, they don't want to bring in this rust. It is a disease that causes a coffee spot, and eventually what the tree does to deal with it, it defoliates. So what you end up with is a bunch of branches, no leaves, and certainly no fruit. And this has devastated the world's coffee industry. Millions and millions and millions, if not billions of dollars, are lost.
So the tree dies.
The tree dies. So what you have to do is you have to stump it, and then it's going to be another 2 years until it comes back. But the important thing is you got to defeat the fungus in that area. And if it's constantly raining, the rust fungus continues to just continue to propagate itself. And so once you've got it, it's pretty hard to get away because it's hiding someplace in the ground or whatever. And so the best thing for us to do, and we've been successful so far, thank God, is to protect against plants and other foreign coffee items coming into the state of Hawaii. And the State Department of Ag, bless their hearts, they're on this. And so far, we've been able to avoid rust. If that hit us, it could be lights out, game over.
Backing up to growing practices, rootstock and utilizing that.
Oh, good question. Another bug that devastates this industry is called the nematode. It's a little microscopic worm, and it lays eggs in the roots. It's all about laying eggs to these pests. They got to find a place to eat, and they got to find a place to lay their eggs. And so they choose to lay eggs in the root system of a coffee tree. Well, you can imagine that if you've got eggs partway up a root, then there's no way for water, chemicals, the fertilizer, etc., to work its way up into the phylum of the tree, out the limb, and to the tree. So the tree actually starts defoliating. You see fewer and fewer leaves. The tree doesn't die necessarily, but it's not propagating any coffee. So the way we fight that is you have to pull the tree. There's no herbicide, there's no pesticide, there's no nothing that's effective in killing this nematode. And this is a worldwide problem. Here I'd say maybe 5-10% of the farms have nematodes. So the way we try to deal with it is ungrafted tree, plant in its place a grafted tree. And by grafted, I mean it would have a Libericum stalk. And these trees are created in the nursery when they're no more than about 4 to 5 inches tall. So we're talking a stem that might be less than a quarter inch thick. You cut a V in it, take stock from like the Arabica trees you want to plant on your farm, whatever the variety. And what you do is you cut just a slice. You put the slice into the V and you put a little bit of tape around it or a little clothespin. I got little micro clothespins. It's kind of cool. And then you just let them grow together. And if they're small enough, the phylum and everything else attaches. And you end up with a tree that has my goodness gracious, you would not want to drink its coffee. It's nematode resistant, not proof, but it's resistant. And it allows the Arabica portion right above the cut to proliferate into a nice, nice coffee tree. So that's called grafting, a big, big part of the industry here. And that's the way you protect against nematodes in the ground.
One thing that we've danced around but haven't really dealt directly with is a huge issue in your world, and that's labor. Everything you've talked about entails labor.
Labor is probably on a spreadsheet, whatever. Labor is probably the big ticket item here on the island. It's very expensive to live here. You're at 40 to 50% depending upon the commodity and gas and whatever, you know, whatever your skew is. Your living costs are about 40% higher, and farms are not immune to that. bringing in fertilizer. It's going to be higher because you got to everything comes here on boats, on barges, and so you're having to fight that. And we have, of course, the Jones Act, which requires U.S. Constructed vessels. You can't use foreign vessels. You can't use foreign companies. You got to have a certain percentage of the crew is American, et cetera. And I love the idea of protecting our military and that kind of thing. But boy, I tell you, the Jones Act has taken a big hit on islanders, Puerto Rico and Hawaii in particular. So these are cost-driving regulations, rules at the congressional level that need to be dealt with.
There's been talk about repealing the Jones Act. I've read about that recently.
Oh, yeah. We have a movement here on the islands trying to deal with that and trying to replace it or modify it, carve exemptions. But we need some relief here on the islands, especially as farmers. So, bottom line, material costs are greatly accentuated because of this particular issue. Labor. A minimum wage now, I think, on a rolling scale that the state legislature passed a couple years ago, I think we're about $10.50 an hour. It's eventually going to go to 15. We pay our people, you know, anywhere from $12 to $15, just labor on the farm. Pickers, of course, are a different situation.
They're piece workers.
They're piecemeal workers. And right now, that's running 80 cents a pound, and most of these guys pick pretty well. So they do very well on a daily income basis. But labor is a huge item. We're competing against coffees, excellent coffees in Central South America, excellent Arabicas, excellent Tipicas, such as what we have here, Tipica being the variety of the most common variety of Arabica in the world. But there we're talking 50 cents an hour. Here we're talking $12 to $15 an hour for field work, maintenance, cutting the grass, and fertilizing, and running tractors, and all that good stuff that goes into farming. And that's why their coffees will sell green in the $4 to $5 a pound range. Retail landed in Houston, landed in New Jersey, landed at the Annex in Oakland, okay? Compared to our coffees, which are, say, 20 on average, plus shipping anywhere from 50 cents to a dollar a pound, depending upon if you're shipping large containers and whatever. So we're at, say, $21-$22 a pound. The imports from Central South America are coming in at $4 to $5 a pound. So you see a 5-to-1 differential. And if people, and most people are cost, price point, cost sensitive, you know, and if you get a fairly good Costa Rican or Guatemalan coffee, Costco or whatever, well, that often is the choice, rather than getting that quintessentially beautiful flavor of a Kona coffee. There is, in my mind, noticeable differences. This is a very unique growing environment, and in my mind, it is definitely worth the extra money to have a wonderful cup of Kona coffee. Very few, even the best farms in Costa Rica, Guatemala, compete with the wonderful flavor of a Kona.
Competition aside, just here on the island is a labor pool, a labor force, attraction, retention of labor. Who are they? Where do they come from? What's your biggest frustration and struggle?
Well, the frustration is finding good labor, men and women that will stay with the farm, grow with us, and who we can rely upon and trust. The key is trust here. Because we have a lot hanging out there, coffee bags. It's not unknown to see a coffee bag of cherry just go missing. And if they can go down the street to a buying station and get $2.10, which is the current price for red cherry right off the tree, and that bag would only get them a dollar or $100, so let's say it's a 100-pound, hypothetical 100-pound bag, $210 versus $100, picking it legitimately at 80 cents a pound, or, you know, the $80 value, $90 value, well, there's temptation there. So we have to have honesty, integrity. We treat our workers here as family, okay?
Are you able to keep and retain a viable workforce?
Yeah, and I can say on this farm, because we do treat our people so well and we pay well, as far as we know, we haven't had a problem with theft. Okay, in the 15 years I've been doing this, people respect us. They appreciate the good condition here. We treat them well. We become friends. I mean, they're part of the Ohana. But that's one of the key points in hiring. Secondly is productivity. We just had to let a crew go because they were not keeping up with cutting the grass. We have 6, 7, 8 foot tall California grass surrounding these trees. Well, when the pickers come in to pick, they don't like that because it makes their job all that much higher. So the team has to work together. So we just laid off a crew that just wasn't doing the job, and we're replacing now with people who want to work and do a good job for us. So getting honest people with integrity, loyalty, and who are proficient in what they do, be farm maintenance or picking, is the challenge that we're faced with every day here. And there's new farms coming online, and so there's a limited pool of pickers, okay? And so now we're competing, and therefore, what does that do to the price of picking? 75 cents, 80 cents, 90 cents, a dollar. And so that is something that we constantly deal with year in and year out.
Do you have a labor contractors on the island, or you hire individually one at a time?
Both. We've had contractors who bring in their people, and they work multiple farms, not just our farm. And so we always got to get their attention, say, hey, Bill, there's a red cherry out in that field, so let's get it picked, you know, like right now. So we always have to try to get our priority in there. We've also had employees that have worked for us directly. Again, how you do it, contract labor or employee, that is not the issue. The issue is getting a good labor pool working your farm that will stay with you. And we've been blessed. We've had people with us for a number of years, but we have also a lot of turnover. Yeah, out in the, I'm just talking the orchard. I'm not talking tours and things like that. But I'm talking field labor, maintenance, mowing, fertilizing, spraying the Botanigard, other sprays, and picking. That is definitely, to your point, that is definitely a challenge for a Kona coffee farmer.
That never ends.
It never ends. And you've got to be on the job, vigilant every day. It ends up on your shoulders as the owner to go out and check and see if they're picking cherry timely or if they're letting it go to raisin. Because at that point, you can't use it. And remember, it's a hideout for that CBB. So there's a double whammy there if you're not picking cherry. When cherry turns red, you've got about a week, maybe 7-8 days max to pick it. And then it starts going purple, and then it goes to raisin, and it's no good.
Let's talk a little bit about the end point of the whole exercise, which is sales and people coming here to purchase and to tour and where your coffee is distributed.
Well, first of all, distribution, we're not in any stores. We sell so much here on this farm, we have a hard time just keeping up with the supply.
Do you mail order, I'm sure?
We do mail order. We have over 1,000 on our monthly customer list.
I imagine there's a real cost benefit to operate that way.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I would say 95% of these people are people that have actually visited the farm. We end up with anywhere from 20 to 100 people a day on the farm. We do a pretty good volume of business right on this farm. So most of our retail sales are between the monthly customer list and the retail sales from people who visit the farm. And it's interesting that most of those people like the coffee so much, they end up on our customer list because they want to keep that little bit of aloha, a little bit of that Hawaiian, that Hawaiian, heavenly Hawaiian coffee coming every month so they can remember all these wonderful images that they had of the island.
So you have a coffee club then?
We have a monthly coffee club, and that's doing very well. So,
what's your number one coffee that people ask for?
Well, it's interesting. One of our workers who grew up on a farm just above us here, I knew him years ago with the dad, they developed a coffee roaster that actually uses mesquite wood and or propane, but mostly wood. And it's fire roasted. And so every Friday we have a fire roasted. It's an old beater. I mean, it's an ugly looking machine, but my gosh, you fire that thing up, you get it to the right temperature, and you get a little bit of that mesquite smoky flavor in the coffee. So it's called fire roasted. That is our number one seller, and people just love it on the tour.
And one more little thing before we go. You're talking about the biggest coffee company retail in the world burning their beans.
Oh, goodness gracious. I'll probably start getting some emails about this, but it's actually a good relationship. We don't have much of a relationship, but we've talked to farmers for Starbucks from Central South America. I was involved in a new large startup here, a couple thousand acres, and we turned to Starbucks teams to help advise us on the best quality coffees to plant here and the varieties and whatever. So within the industry, kind of tongue in cheek, we call Starbucks Charbucks. And I get a kick out of it when we start talking about this. Starbucks is an excellent coffee company. They buy the top 5%. They buy specialty coffee around the world. My hat's off to them. Howard Schultz has done a wonderful job taking this from three stores near Pike's Place in Seattle to the mega company that he has right now. And he's retired, obviously, from turning it over to Johnson as the president. But wonderful company, great model. But it's interesting to note, they own one or two farms is all. So they're very smart in risk aversion because farming is where the risks are. But number two, they do contract with farms, and so they're basically controlling the trees on farms and getting some of the best coffees of the world. But I find, in my opinion, I like just brewed coffee, especially Kona. When it's got a sweet flavor, I don't need to run it through the espresso machine, although a lot of people do. Use our Heavenly Hawaiian in creating espressos. And I do at home. I admit that. I confess. But we kind of joke about the Charbucks. So one way to make a coffee, any coffee from around the world, kind of tastes the same, because that's the whole idea. It's the McDonald's principle. You go to Moscow, you buy a hamburger, it better taste the same as New York or Chicago. And Charbucks, it kind of does the same thing. And so you super roast the coffees at 470, 480 to get a very dark French roast, okay? And that also puts a little bit of tang, a little more bitterness into the coffee, and then you dumb it down with milks, sugars, and flavors. But that creates the drink that millions and millions and millions of people love. But that's the Charbucks story.
I love it. I'm going to have to come back because I could pick your brain for another 2 hours. But for now, I'm going to have to say aloha. Before we go, if somebody wanted to learn more, go to your website or whatever, where would you direct them?
Well, we have an excellent website at heavenlyhawaiian.com. And on it, there are many links to other companies, to my company down in McKinney, Texas, called Texacona, where hula meets howdy. There's a reference point there, a reference to being able to rent our VRBO on the farm here, right across the pool from the main office.
For a moment, I hate to divert, but this is a great story in itself, a standalone story.
Oh, it is. Coffee, obviously, you can just see how much I've enjoyed this over 15 years. And I used to tell people that a bad day on the coffee farm is a heck of a lot better than a good day in the courtroom. I love this. This is just a wonderful business. It's tough. Being a farmer is extremely tough. It's very risky, and you got to know what you're doing. But I tell you, we see the smiling faces of all the tourists that come and visit the VRBO and or our
So thing. Some people come to your VRBO that might not even be coffee drinkers. They just love this place. Give us a two-minute word picture.
Well, yeah, we actually do have people that that come and kind of confess, I'm a tea drinker. I don't drink any caffeine. Well, give me 2 days with them. They'll be drinking, and I've had many, many stories of people who have tried the coffee, found it to be so mellow, you don't need to put milk, sugar into it, just drink it straight, that they then, and I've had them report back to me, they are now committed coffee drinkers.
I love it. A missionary.
A coffee missionary. Spreading the word. That's right. My name is Dave Bateman. Trudy and I own Heavenly Hawaiian Farms in Hualalai, Hawaii.
We'll see you here. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Big Island of Hawaii.
This program came from Hawaii.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org